On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we will try and explain why no team is going to win 100 baseball games in a season for the first time in a decade. We'll then boot up the panic synonym meter machine and tell you our level of anxiety, agitation, apprehension, concern, consternation about the teams in contention. And then we'll leave on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows 100. It's just a number. I'm Jake Mance, that's Jordan Schusterman. And you remember when you were younger and the 100th day of school was a big, big deal?
I do. That's actually a very funny comparison. As today on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast, we are going to talk about 100 wins and the importance of 100 wins, whether 100 wins matters, whether the fact that it seems like no team this season is going to get to 100 wins matters. But I'll be honest, Jake, this is actually good timing because my perspective of the number 100 has been warped over the last 4 days as I have driven on Canadian highways telling me that I can drive 100. Oh, I can drive 100? Oh, great. Oh my gosh, I'm going to absolutely floor. Oh no, just kidding. Just kidding. It's that's in kilometers. But, you know, it is kind of a perspective of like, hey, all these numbers mean different things to different people. And perhaps this season, Jake Mintz, we should adjust, maybe not as dramatically down as to the difference between kilometers and miles, but maybe we should realize that 100 is too many. It's too many wins. Why do we need to have 100 wins?
Is everyone mid? And that is the question that will guide this here podcast. Mm-hmm. The season is long and full of terrors. That is a truth. As is 100 being a nice, sexy round number. Now, is a big round number a bizarre stopping point for any counting exercise? Yes. But take a look at the number 100. It looks so nice. It does. 1,000 has too many zeros. 11 doesn't have enough. 100 is just a pleasure to gaze upon.
Yeah. Well, and 1,000, you know, now we're introducing commas, right? And now we're kind of interrupting the flow of the kind of numerical kind of communication and just like collaboration of the one, the zero, and the zero. But no, it's totally true, agree. Man. There's something. And by the way, you know, I joke about, okay, 100 means different, especially as it relates to miles per hour, kilometers per hour. But I also still marvel at the fact that like, 100 is the right number for velocity for us to be like, wow, that is it. Like, it kind of is a great barrier of like tells us, okay, this is legitimate velocity. And I'm curious if we can apply that to a team, to baseball team win totals, because normally it's like you win 100 games, you are excellent. And if we are not going to have any 100 win teams, in theory, we are saying we do not have any excellent teams.
You are typically the spreadsheet god of this pair. However, I've been grinding on Google Sheets over the last couple days, crunching those numbers to try and figure out how rare it is that we're not going to have any 100 win teams. Let's actually get that out of the way first before we jump into the past. So right now, the Dodgers and the Gardos are tied for the best record in baseball. They're at 71-49. That is a .592 winning percentage, which over the course of a full season correlates to 95 wins. That is not 100. That's actually fewer than 100. Both of these teams would have to go 29-13 over their remaining 42 games in order to win 100. 29-13 is possible. Teams go 29-13, not all the time, but it happens quite often. It is also unlikely. To go 29-13 in a 42-game stretch is to be very, very en fuego. And so I would say it is unlikely that we get an 100-win team this season. Now, if you turn back the clock, we have had an 100-win team, at least one, every year since 2015. You can take COVID, crumble that up, throw it away. No team won 100 games because they only had 60 opportunities to do so, and that is how math works. Last season, we had 3. Year before that, we had 4. 2021, we had 3. 2019, 4. 18, 3. 17, 3. 16 and 15, we had 1 apiece. So we've had at least 3 100 win teams every year since 2017. And this year, we're almost certainly going to have 0. And the overwhelming question is why. I've asked people around the game their thoughts on this. And there's a bunch of different varying opinions on it. So, Jordan, let me ask you that very macro question. Why are we not going to have an 100-win team?
Yeah, I think that this gets to some similar discourse that we have around the trade deadline, where, you know, with the extra wild card, we spend a lot of times talking about the middle, and that the middle is a lot of teams that aren't necessarily, I mean, let's forget excellent, but even like great. Because I think we could say that, like, there are these teams that we're about to talk about in relation to a panic meter in relation can be are good teams. It's not like there aren't any good teams, but great teams, excellent teams, you know, powerhouse teams. And I think that if you have the teams in the middle, if there are fewer teams that are terrible, like terrible, terrible, which I do think that's another thing, there are fewer opportunities to just rack up easy dubs. And so if we're just strictly looking at the records versus the actual quality of the team, because I would still argue in some of these cases, you look at some of these rosters and they do look like great rosters. In some cases, it's a little bit harder to argue. They look like rosters of 100-win teams. I do still feel that way when I look at some of these teams. However, when the quality of the middle is, I think, slightly better and the bottom, except for the very, very, very bottom, is a little bit better, it's just fewer gimmies because fewer teams are just full-blown punting. So that would be my general theory on just how we get to these records. But maybe I'm off base.
So I would say there was a stretch from, you know, 18 to 22, 23, where having all these dominant teams, having less parity, having a larger gap between the haves and the have-nots, that was something that was labeled as bad in baseball, right? Yeah. The top heavy and bottom falling out of the league. And we are, at least this season, pushing those ends together. And the White Sox are just kind of in there. There are 29 baseball teams. The White Sox are an aberration in every single way. So let's just get them out of here, right? I think that it is asking people who know more about baseball than we do, the sense I get is they believe that this is an aberration and not a sign of things to come. There's a small theory that, like, all of the advantages that teams found after data, especially like batted ball data, tracking data, entered the game in like 15, 16, 17, 18, we've now reached almost a softening of those advantages. Where, like, as an example, the Astros were the first team to kind of realize, hey, spin rate on a curveball is really big. It's the Colin McHugh. They found Colin McHugh because his spin rate was really good and they turned him into something, right? That's just a very oversimplifying example. We have reached somewhat of a rounding of that data where teams are all working with the same thing and are in a lot of ways using that data in a similar way. And so the advantages that teams had over a period of time have kind of, they're not the same as they were.
And yeah, I would say that applies to like everything, right? We talk about it with the draft because every team has some version of a model that is spitting out the same statistical combination of college data. And it's like, yeah, okay, this guy's about. And so that's why you don't see as many industry picks where it's like, whoa, where did that come from? And I think part of that too is that teams, you see it with defensive positioning. That's a huge one. We saw with the Astros also, right? Like most of the teams, 25 plus of the teams are running some combination of the same thing. And so you have, as you mentioned, kind of a homogeneity of thinking. And especially when teams now, front offices now, are so focused on being kind of correct, but also like in line with what is just modern progressive thinking, that you end up with just a lot of the same things. On top of the fact that when you also think about what is another relevant part of baseball in 2024, which is that hitting is very hard and pitching is very good. And as we get to, like, for example, you just have guys coming up with stuff that would have overwhelmed everybody, you know, 10, 20 years ago that are fringe big leaguers. It has also leveled out just the amount of kind of progress you can make offensively that is any team is liable to just look absolutely dreadful on offense. And that has clearly impacted a lot of these teams that we are going to talk about in a very real way. And then the bullpen is just so volatile that, as we always talk about, that can sink any team, no matter how good they are.
So let's get a little specific, right? Which teams had an opportunity to win 100 games, in theory, if things had broken right? If you look at the preseason projections, those models very, very, very rarely project a team to win 100 games. It's very unlikely. That does not really happen. That being said, the Braves were pegged for 98. And I would say that over the course of the season, the teams that had a sniffing chance at this, Baltimore, New York, the Yankees, not the Mets, Cleveland, Atlanta, Philly, and LA. I want to begin with the Braves because they're kind of the easiest discussion. Arguably the best hitter on the planet, best position player on the planet, Ronald Acuna Jr., was meh for 2 months and then his leg exploded. And Spencer Strider, who's a top three pitcher in the world, blew out at the beginning of the season. That's it. I think that when you take those two guys away, both could have been worth 6.5 to 7 wins. I mean, they're your 14 wins. That's it. So I don't really think there are a lot of other things to talk about when it relates to the Braves. But in terms of why are the Braves not going to win 100 games, injuries to Acuna and Strider, that's simple. I don't really want to hang on that anymore. I think Cleveland is also kind of simple. I don't think they were really ever good enough to win 100 games. I understand that they are tied for the best record in baseball and they deserve a lot of credit for that. You're around this team more than I am. The talent on the roster, particularly on the pitching side, just doesn't seem like it's ever been, the ceiling's never been there.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that they're clearly trying to patch in a pretty dramatic way. I mean, we just saw Matt Boyd look very good. He's now joined the rotation, but they have benefited from, like, their offense was good enough to give them enough leads early in games. And then now we have a bullpen that is honestly, at least statistically, been so far and away the best in the league that they've just converted so many close games to wins in a way that is a good way to kind of get out ahead of it. And now they're trying to balance things out and try, you know, by trading for Lane Thomas and trying to add some of these veteran pitchers, they're trying to balance out the roster. And that's a tough thing to do. Like they had to have known that there was a level of regression coming. But I think that ultimately what happened was they were able to bank so many wins, which they count the same. You know, those wins that you bank in May are going to count the same that they do in September, but they're not going to feel as important. And that's what a lot of these teams that have had big leads are not exactly feeling that way. The way Seattle was up by 10 games and Cleveland was up by a ton of games and the Dodgers were up by a ton of games. In that way, it doesn't feel like those wins are worth the same, but ultimately they are. And that's why they're still going to be relevant at the end of the season here.
And I would say injuries are applicable to two other teams here, and that would be the Orioles and the Dodgers, particularly on the pitching side with both of these. The Dodgers losing Mookie Betts for that extended stretch is not going to be the difference between 100 and 95 wins. It could be. But losing him, obviously, that's a big one. Losing Muncy, that's a big one. That was not baked into our understanding of these teams. And then the Dodgers have just had so many pitching injuries, and we'll touch on that a little bit later. The latest being River Ryan, who's going to get Tommy John surgery. But they just haven't gotten anything from Buehler. They haven't gotten anything from Bobby Miller. They've had Yamamoto's been out for an extended period. And so to me, all of those pitching injuries and losing Mookie Betts is the gap between 100 and whatever they're going to end at. And then the similar thing with the Orioles where, you know, Kyle Bradish finished fourth in the AL Cy Young and hasn't thrown a pitch since May because his arm exploded. Tyler Wells got Tommy John. John Means got Tommy John. Grayson Rodriguez has now been out for a stretch. Yeah. And so, if no Felix Bautista, right? I think the Orioles, the lack of their pitching is just not good enough really to be an 100-win team. Some of that is injuries. Some of that is that the front office, you know, hasn't shown the ability to develop internally to the same extent as they have on the hitting side.
I would just say that, like, I'm glad you mentioned all the injuries because we've brought it up before. And that is the part that I certainly hope is an aberration for this season. I mean, I don't necessarily feel like that will definitely be the case, certainly in terms of the pitching, because of just that's kind of where we're at with pitching in 2024 and what we're in theory going to keep moving on forward before we find the magic making sure my elbow doesn't hurt, you know, medication. I just think that, like, for the amount of position players that we've lost for significant time, we talked about this a few weeks ago. Like, you really can't find a team that has not lost a significant player, hitter and pitcher, to either season ending or months plus long injury. It's basically every team. And maybe that has been the case in recent seasons, and we're just noticing it more now because we're looking for reasons to explain why these teams aren't very good. But in my head, like, it has felt dramatic enough to make it feel like why, hopefully not something that is just a universal truth moving forward.
And then the Yankees and the Phillies are the two other teams. And to me, they got off to such enfuego starts at the beginning of the year and racked up so many wins that they were kind of playing above their true talent level, above their skis. I mean, remember, I might be wrong, I think the Phillies were projected for 85 wins by Fangraphs at the beginning of the season. The Yankees, I think, were around 88, right? So they were playing like 105 win teams for a big stretch. They've come back to earth, which is just closer to where we thought they'd be statistically at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, we had, I have all those win totals in front of me. Yeah, Fangraphs and Pecota had the Phillies at 85. Pecota had the Yankees at 94, but Fangraphs had them at 89. So yeah, I mean, again, coming into the year, I think the teams we kind of described as in play for 100 were kind of that group. But even the projections were more down on Houston than they had been in recent seasons, certainly more down on the Yankees. And then you have that cluster of teams like Tampa Bay and Toronto who have projected well. You know, Toronto was a team that Pecota had at 88 wins, and that was one of the highest totals of any team. And we obviously know how backwards they've gone. Like, we've also had some teams that we looked at as having elite talent that have gone strong in the other direction and have kind of lessened the group of contenders that we're actually going to have.
Most of the people that I talk to about this in front offices expect us to have an 100 win team again next season, that this is more of a blip than it is a trend. But it is really stark. I mean, we had three last year, four the year before that, and we're going to have none. My question for you, Jordan, before we take a break, is this a good thing? Is this flattening positive? Does it make the league more entertaining to follow? Will it make October less entertaining? I'm curious whether you, how do you feel about this?
Well, right. When we talk about it in a wild card context, and ultimately what we end up saying is, oh, look at all these 80 to 85 win teams kind of trying to crawl their way and just claw their way into, oh, here we sneak in the third, and then who knows, anything can happen. And a lot of fans, I feel like, oh, really? Should we be rewarding these not actually great teams to get into the postseason? And that's its own discourse. But so then what is the upside and downside of not having any teams that are way out ahead of everybody else, right? Is, in theory, division races, right? And division races are inherently more compelling than the race for the third wild card, where it just looks like, are any of these teams actually that good? And so there is something, I think, to be said if you're just thinking about the casual fan, you know, experience, which I think we have to take into consideration as much as we possibly can, which is that winning the division is extremely important now. And I think it's something that if there was ways to continue to incentivize it more, I think it would also continue to be a good thing in baseball. And if those are still relevant, because I feel like recently we've had a few where it's like, we got division races wrapping up on September 10th. And it's like, all right, well, that's fine. And now we're just looking at all these teams and the race, which is what September is about, we're talking about teams that are just not that compelling. Now, we all know that they can get in and then just go on a run, but I think that's maybe the discourse around like a postseason race has in some cases been lost because some of these teams are so far ahead.
I think that there's a balance, though. Not that I'm afraid of this, but I like it when we have monsters and minnows, when we have juggernauts and underdogs, where does it feel silly when an 85 win wild card team can knock off an 104 win division champ in a 5-game set? Like, yeah, that feels kind of wonky, but the narrative heft of that is fun. Seeing the Diamondbacks go into LA last year and pants them was like, whoa, wow, that's crazy. Where if you have two 92 win teams, it's like, well, can't wait for this coin flip. And there's still good narrative drama in that. But I think that having both at the same time is probably the best option. Either way, we'll see if any of these teams can end up with 100 wins. I don't think they will. I'm going to continue asking around the league about this. And if I get any answers that explain it, like Rob Manfred said, no 100 win teams, then I'll definitely let everybody know. Let's take a quick break. And when we return, we're going to boot up the panic synonym machine. Welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. We just talked about how there are no 100 win teams incoming. And part of that is because the good first half teams have not been the good second half teams and vice versa. So before we boot up the panic meter, let's just get the obvious out of the way. Arizona rips. San Diego bops. And the Astros have figured their things out.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess in theory, again, we just talked about it with Houston after they swept Boston. It's like when you watch them, it's like, oh yeah, that's the Astros. Okay, what's the big deal? And I think San Diego and Arizona were versions. We saw versions of the team where it's like, oh yeah, this is definitely a team that can look a lot better. Certainly, no matter what they did in the offseason after last year, we're going to think about Arizona differently. But yeah, I think especially in the AL. Where Kansas City, I think even as a Kansas City defender, it was like, listen, there's a version where they make the postseason, but we know they're slowing down and they're not going to win 100 games. But I do think that, like, when we talk about these best teams, and I always am amused by like how and why we choose to apply a panic meter, because I think about this in a Mariners context all the time, but like, who really should be worried? Is it the teams that are in danger of falling out of relevance, or is it the teams in danger of falling out of having the best record in baseball? And when your standards are raised over the course of a season, that very much dictates the fan experience.
And I think that makes the Phillies a very good place to start. This was the best team in baseball for a significant stretch of the season. Since they got back from London, remember, they went to frickin' London.
They sure did.
Played the Mets twice. Since they got back from London on June 11th, they are 24 and 30. They are 24 and 30. They have the second worst record in baseball since the All-Star break. They lost last night to the Miami Marlins, one of the worst teams in baseball, against a pitcher who I will admit I had never heard of before in my life, Valente Belozo, threw seven strong, allowed four hits, and shut the Phillies out. It was rock bottom for a team that has been skidding. Their Trey Turner looks like he's wearing a sleep mask. Nick Castellanos and Kyle Schwarber have been good, but everyone else just does not look right. Jordan, please. None of that matters if they show up in October and they rake and they have set those standards high considering of what they've done the last two postseasons. So please, go to this list of synonyms that I asked ChatGPT to give me and pick out your level of panic for the Philadelphia Phillies right now.
Yeah, so a lot of options here. I think, right, it's certainly a spectrum. I know these are technically synonyms according to ChatGPT, but some of them sound a lot more dramatic than others, right? The fact that hysteria is kind of a default setting for some of these fan bases anyway. That's another thing, is like when you're applying it specifically to Phillies fans. But it's always so funny because while I don't disagree with you when you're like rock bottom, shut out by Valente Belozo, I'm still looking at them six games up in the division and I'm like, yeah, rock bottom sounds pretty nice, you know?
19 games above 500.
Right, right. And it's also funny you mentioned the London trip as the cutoff, because if I recall, the London trip, again, we're just making stuff up in terms of arbitrary endpoints. That's when the Mets started on gets hot, right? They won like, you know, 15 of their next 18 games after going across the pond. So, you know, that's long enough now that different things have kind of impacted their experience. But to your question, I think I'm sticking with unease. Unease is the good one, because restlessness is kind of an interesting one. We talk about like, what's the word you kind of have where it's just complacency, right? That's the managers like to use it. Oh, okay. How are we getting up for this game? It's the Marlins. We're just supposed to, you know, sleepwalk past these guys. It's like, no, actually, Belozo says otherwise.
I think the Phillies right now are anxiety. Mm. Their season ended last year in such an embarrassing fashion to head home, needing one win to go to the World Series against the Arizona Diamondbacks and losing two at Citizens Bank Park in games where their offense was just flailing at flies. And the last month, they have looked like that team. And those two games against Arizona have been the cloud for the Phillies this whole year. Really, even when they were playing well, some of the narrative was, this is great. Does it even matter if they show back up in October and they swing at sliders in the other batter's box? No, it doesn't matter. But for this past month, and I think that particularly with Trey Turner, where Trey Turner in that series, just horrible. And over the last month, he has been abysmal. And so I think it is the anxiety of embarrassing, for fans at least, it is the anxiety of seeing the team embarrass themselves on the national stage again. Plus the anxiety of the Eagles, because so many of these Phillies fans are Eagles fans. And my understanding is that the Eagles were 10-1 in the NFL and then bungled their way down the stretch and lost in October, in football October. And so yeah. I think for the Phillies, it is anxiety. I'm very interested in their situation because their manager, Rob Thompson, his superpower is that he doesn't panic. Like he doesn't stress. And so any move that he makes that looks like a panic move could have really negative reverberations if people are like, oh, Rob's panicking? Like, we're done.
When you bring up Rob Thompson, I just want to say that, like, let's also go back to October, right? We were losing. How is he not changing the lineup? Now, I don't know if people are feeling that weight. And he didn't. He never did. Right. And it was like, yeah, because these are my guys. These are my boys. And this year is going to be an even kind of greater example of that, because in all likelihood, even with the struggles, like, they're going to roll in. I still believe as the division champs, and even more of a, like, these are the guys that got us here. This is the team, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm even more curious about how, I don't really know what buttons there are to press specifically, and maybe you have better insight into that.
I do. So last night, really for the first time, Rob Thompson, it feels like every day someone asks him about the lineup, and he got asked about it after the loss last night, and he said something along the lines of, we're getting close. We're getting close to making a change. And so if Thompson's turning a dial or, you know, flipping a switch, I think that's pretty indicative. Enough of the Phillies. Let's go to the Braves. The Atlanta Braves are 37-43 since May 15th. Now, again, you mentioned this. We could pick arbitrary endpoints for any of these teams and draw conclusions from it. But they are six games under 500 since the middle of May. That is significant. They have won their last two games, big games in San Francisco against the Giants, to cut the division lead that the Phillies have down to six games. Feels like the closest it's been in some time. They are back in possession of the last playoff spot, two games above the New York Mets. Jordan, please give me an adjective to describe the Atlanta Braves.
I would say...
Are these adjectives? No. Adverbs?
No.
Descriptor.
Kind of, descriptor. State of being. I'm going to go with agitation. I think that in this case, I don't know, because, like, they are the team where it's like you can kind of throw your hands up. We had it with the sorry for your mentions, where it's just like, ah, screw it. You know, the season's over. All of our guys are hurt. Like, let's just give up, which is not very fan like behavior. This isn't a word that's here, because, again, it's not necessarily an adjective or panic, but it's just like, despondence. It's just like dismay. Yeah, I think dismay is a good one. I think dismay is the right one, because this is the team that just feels like it's not us, right? We don't have it this year.
And we are not him.
Yeah, we are not him. That is, more than any of these other good teams, that is really the one, because that doesn't really apply to these other teams.
Well, I'm just saying within
problems.
The fan base. Yeah. Like, no one in the room in Atlanta is like, we are not, this team is not good enough.
I think dismay
every team
is,
thinks they're good enough.
Yeah. Dismay is the one here. I think that does do it more than these other ones, because the other teams, based on the expectations, it was different and the injuries aren't quite as dramatic. So dismay, I feel good about that.
So the one thing with the Braves that has been their North Star kind of all season long is that if they get into the playoffs, which I still think they will, the rotation is pretty formidable to 3-game set with Chris Sale, who, oh my God, was he so good the other night against the Giants. He's been amazing. He's going to win the Cy Young. But with Sale, Max Fried, and Ronaldo Lopez all looking great and awesome, Fried has not looked the same since he's come off the IL. And Ronaldo is still on the IL, and they're monitoring Spencer Schwellenbach's innings. And so, yes, Chris Sale against anybody, I'll take Chris Sale right now. That being said, I feel a little bit less good about the way that their pitching lines up in a short series. One more NL East team, the New York Mets. The New York Mets are 2 games back in the division. Or sorry, two games back in the wild card. They have lost 4 games in a row. They're 3-7 in their last 10. OMG? Whoa, by the way, yo, did you see what happened last night?
I did. I did see Austin Adams. Austin Adams really, first of all, former Mets.
Who Austin Adams? Right? Who Austin Adams?
Who's Austin Adams? Oh my gosh. Well, don't get me started. He is honestly the hit by pitch king. This is a great example of there are some relievers like this, like Johan Ramirez fits in this bucket too, where it's like, if your stuff is good enough, especially in relief capacity, and we can keep it in you know, short stints, teams are just going to keep giving you a chance and won't care whatsoever if you have 20 to 30 grade command. If you can keep striking guys out, that is what is going to happen. And he is leading the league in hit by pitches once again this season. Austin Adams is, and he's been in the A's bullpen for much of the year, but he's got good stuff. But he was on, why did I think he was on the Mets? Am I completely,
I believe he was on the Mets in spring training.
Spring training. Okay. All right. Thank you. That is so validating. I was like, I swear they had Austin Adams at some point. They pulled up his baseball reference page and he's nowhere to be found. They did sign him in the offseason, and it seems like the A's claimed him on waivers at the very end of spring training. So this is, which kind of adds to the intrigue of the spice involved here.
They traded Austin Adams to the Mets on March 24th. Austin Adams gets out of an inning last night. I think the A's are up by like a comfortable amount, and does like the Mets OMG celebration that they do for Jose Iglesias. And it's just, it's such a hilarious thing, because if you're the Mets, you can't get mad at the guy on the A's. Like, he doesn't care. He's like, yeah, I did that. Whatever.
Right. And the Mets DFA'd him for Diekman. So that's, I guess, how at the end of spring training, and we know Diekman has had an interesting run in the, in the Mets bullpen this year.
So anyway, all that being said, the Mets, give me a word.
Okay. So again, we have to adjust for expectations. I would say restlessness. The reason why I'm going to go with that, and maybe this is me projecting onto them, right? But it's like, okay, when are we going to be like the big bad Mets? You know, you tried it, it didn't work. And now it's like, okay, how long is this process of like accepting mediocrity going to last? And I think that could also bring in a few other words here, which maybe you're going to bring up. But it's just like kind of looking towards the future and being like, hold on a second, like, where are we going here? Because we have a lot of good players right now. And it seems like this isn't a great team because of some of the decisions that we've made.
So that's when I'm going to hop in and interrupt you here.
Yes.
The word is fear. The word is fear that you were never good enough at all along. In the Mets' hot stretch during the middle of the season, the idea that that might have been the blip and that the mediocrity is the truth, that's fear. That's what fear is all about. I was never good enough. Was I good enough? Fear. That's the horror. I mean, horror is probably too far. Horror is on this list. I'm just going to go with fear. It's fear that you are never good enough and fear that you might not be good enough moving forward. Enough in the NL East. Let's head to the Dodgers.
Okay.
Because the Dodgers have been good. However, elbows are exploding. River Ryan, who came up and looked pretty good for them, he is the latest victim. He will have Tommy John surgery, the Dodgers announced, out for the season. There is a longer conversation to be had that requires a lot of reporting about how the teams that are the best, quote, at pitching development, Tampa, the Dodgers, are the ones that have the most elbow injuries. That seems like causation to me. Right. I cannot prove that. I'm not going to just bang my fist on the table and fight for that. It can't be a coincidence in my mind. That's all I'm saying.
Well, and again, I also think that it is probably worth at least mildly adjusting our definition of good pitching development, because there's a lot of ways that I think teams get credit for being good at pitching development. And I think that is an interesting conversation in and of itself, right? Is it that you are able to produce a lot of pitchers that can appear in the big leagues, period? Is it that you can create out-getters from unlikely places in relief roles? We certainly have seen that with both Tampa and, you know, the Dodgers in a very extreme way. But, you know, is the bar higher? You know, should it only be about starting pitching? In which case, you look at what Philadelphia has been able to do recently. You look at what Cleveland was able to do and is now struggling to do. You look at what Seattle has obviously done better than anybody over the last 3 or 4 years. There's pitching is not as you can't just say pitching, right? And that is the thing that I think we need to kind of reflect on our own, which is just what does it even mean to be good at pitching development? But the point is here is that the Dodgers are indeed. I mean, it's. You know, Miami, another team, right? We've seen, oh, wow, look at all these awesome pitchers. Oh, now they're all hurt. So I don't know. Because of the time that we're talking about this, maybe you just say, yeah, this is just part of baseball in 2024. This is what you got to deal with. And, you know, it's weird, right? Yamamoto, am I applying that to Yamamoto? That doesn't really seem like that makes a whole lot of sense versus the guys like River Ryan and Gonsolin and Dustin May who have kind of come up with the Dashian, right? So, I mean, they really have lost a lot of these guys.
So my word for them is trepidation, just because I don't know who the heck's going to start in October. Yeah. Right now, it's Glasnow, Kershaw, Gavin Stone, Jack Flaherty, and then Walker Buehler is set to start tomorrow on Thursday. Mm-hmm. Do I think all those five guys are going to be healthy in the postseason? I don't know. I literally have no idea. And so for me, the word is trepidation for the Los Angeles Dodgers, because the pitching injuries just give me a whole lot of unease. Maybe unease is applicable too. Let's move to the American League and do a couple more teams. I want to start with the Guardians, because the Guardians have surpassed expectations this season. That they are tied for the best record in baseball on August 14th is an accomplishment. They seem very likely to make the playoffs at all. That is sensational for a first-year manager and Steven Vogt and a team that last year was frankly very mediocre. However, since June 26th, press the arbitrary date horn, they're 20-23, but they've actually been worse than 20-23 since that date. Since that date, here are some ranks. 23rd in starter ERA, 27th in starter FIP, which is fielding independent pitching, essentially an ERA projection that takes batted balls out of the equation. They are 27th in team WRC plus and 28th in team WRC plus and 27th in runs. They only have three hitters who've been above average. The Guardians have just been like, now for 2 months.
Yeah, but, I mean, you pull up just their full season rankings, and what you find is an average offense, a starting pitching ERA that is 20, the starting pitcher's 24th in ERA whip, walks per nine, last in home runs allowed per nine. So this is maybe the most dramatic part of their team, which is that their bullpen, which is first in ERA, first in whip, first in hits allowed, first in home runs allowed per nine, is again 30th the starters in home runs. And that is where you can really swing some games where it feels like you're in them and you have a bullpen that can keep it close. And then, oh, never mind. Our starter just gave up a 3-run home run in the fifth. And now we don't necessarily have the offense to get back to it. Now, to your point, it has certainly been worse recently. And the offense is, I think, the thing that early in the season, we were like, hey, you really only need a few good hitters, right? You only need, you know, Naylor and Jose Ramirez and Kwan. Now, Kwan's been cold enough now for long enough where it's like, all right, now we're starting to slip, and he's such an important part at the top of the lineup that it just becomes a lot harder to score runs when he is not reaching base. I think John Kenzie Noel is a very interesting part of this conversation. I know there are a lot of Guards fans that want to see him playing every day, regardless of maybe some defensive deficiencies in the outfield. But that's going to be the thing here. And Lane Thomas has certainly not been anything close to what they had hoped, you know, so far offensively. So Again, I still think that you when you have this superpower bullpen and you do have one of the best players in baseball in Ramirez, you're going to be okay. But I think the word here, I do think concern, I think apprehension, I think, again, projecting ahead here is not much has changed. I mean, we were scared about the pitching 2 months ago. We're even more scared about the pitching now, even with some of the reinforcements that they have. And I think that's the thing, is looking at it and almost kind of looking at it like, when is this really going to entirely topple?
If this is an apprehension, I don't know what is. AL East. New York Yankees. So the New York Yankees of New York are 22-29 since June 13th. All right. Arbitrary end date button. Since that day, it's been the offense has gotten gotten a lot of the criticism, but the starting pitching has just straight up not been very good since that date. Over the last week, they got mercy ruled by the White Sox, losing 12-2. Chaz Chisholm has a UCL issue in his non-throwing arm that might require surgery. We'll probably have more news on that by the time this podcast is in your ears. And still, they have opened up a one-game lead in the AL East. The Yankees are, how would I describe it? You know what? They're falling upwards is how I take their last 2 months. Where are you at with the Yankees? It's a weird situation right now. Soto and Judge can't get out, and everything else gives me worry, straight up worry. I'm worried.
Well, I am curious too, as we bring the Orioles here into this discussion as well. I think, man, Yankees fans communicate, and you know, our producer Andrew Hartz is one of them, a level of, you know what you don't see here? I guess, like, what is the closest here to anger? I guess agitation, right? Like
hysteria.
Hysteria. Hysteria is almost implies a level of confusion and just like disbelief. But I don't think it's disbelief, right? I don't think it's like, because that's the thing about Yankees fans is they feel like they're like, no, of course this is happening. When you leave the same people in it, Boone and Cashman, of course, we knew all the problems coming into the season. Of course, they're coming up again. And so that's the thing. But what do you disagree with that?
Fury.
Mm.
Wrath. Irritation. That is the energy. Annoyance, right? Perpetual exasperation. And I think Aaron Boone, I'm still pro Boone, had a quote recently that resonated with me where he, after the loss to the White Sox, he's like, look, for us, it's 162 seasons. And whether we win or we lose on a given day, it's either, you know, everyone loves us or hates us. And we have to completely ignore that. And so I think for me, exasperation is the word I will use as far as how I feel about the team. I am weirdly now more concerned about the pitching than I am about the offense.
Yeah. And that's another one where again, this is generally an interesting conversation with any postseason team, but particularly with the Yankees because of how good they were at the start of the season. How are you lining these guys up? You know, let's say they win the division and we're rolling in, because we haven't really talked about Gerrit Cole much over the last like 3 or 4 weeks. You know, we talked about him after his first few starts and it was like, oh, there's Gerrit Cole. And then, that didn't look so good. And we were like, hey, and you said, whatever he looks like in October, that's all that matters. And I agreed with that. And there's still a long way to go before then. I mean, how would you rank their, let's say you had to do a postseason rotation tomorrow. Just three. I don't know. You'd have to go five or four or five deep. I mean, It's hard.
It's so funny too, and I'll answer your question. Clark Schmidt is on his way back, and the way that people are talking about Clark Schmidt, there's no stink on him right now. It's like Schrodinger's Schmidt. Like, we don't know what he is when he returns until he comes back, and so it's like, oh my god, he'd be so much better than these other guys. It's like, right, the other guys are still decent. I would line it up. I think they will go Cole, Rodon, Heel.
Yeah.
I think it will slightly depend on the matchup. If there's a team that is bad against lefties, I could see Nestor getting in there. He is the one that honestly worries me the most in a postseason context, because he's just liable to give up a monster dong. Yeah. I think when it's all said and... Like, does Clark Schmidt start a playoff game is a great way to
Yeah, this. Schmidt is an interesting character here, and Heal is one too in a postseason context where it's like the dude could just go out there and walk three of the first four batters, you know.
And that's it.
And like that is just like, if you're managing a postseason game, there's nothing quite like postseason starter, you know, walking multiple guys in the first inning, and they pan to the manager, and the manager's just like, how in the world am I going to get through this one? because it's one thing, you know, in August. It's another thing when it's like every decision you make from that inning on is going to likely impact the rest of the series. And so, yeah, that's a moment that Luis Heal would. But he at his best, he's looked like their best pitcher.
Last thing I'll say. Marcus Stroman is, here's a scenario. Marcus Stroman could get left off a playoff roster.
Yeah.
That is
in play. Certainly a shorter series. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah. Totally in play. Yeah. How that goes down, fascinated to watch.
ERA 6. Like, what are you going to say? Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry.
Last team, quickly. We've gone too long here. Orioles is very simple. For me, I would say it is terror. Their flaw all season long has been a lack of starting pitching. At the deadline, they only kind of addressed it. Zach Eflin has been very good. Trevor Rogers is just not good enough. He's not good enough to start a postseason game. And I'm just surprised the Orioles think that he is good enough to start a postseason game, because that's how it lines up right now. And the terror is that they just get into a series and they just don't have the arms. And it's been the terror all year, and it continues to terrorize anybody who cares about the Orioles. Let's take a break, Jordan. And when we get back, we'll bop around the league, talk about a couple of the news and notes that have been entering our brains. And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mance, Jordan Schusterman. Let's just fly around the traps here. A couple different things I want to bring up. First thing, Jarren Duran. We talked about this on Monday before the suspension came down for him dropping a homophobic slur while he was literally at home plate. Got a 2-game temporary ban. He is coming back tonight on Wednesday. Him getting the suspension means he will not play 162 games, which is something he was on pace to do and something he definitely cared about. He talked to reporters. And for me, biggest issue I had with what he said, Jordan, was when someone asked him if it was a word he's ever used before, and he said no. There is absolutely no way that that's possible. I refuse to believe that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like, this is one of those situations with the statement and with his comments after, you know, it's not, I don't really, I mean, it's not that there aren't better apologies than others. I recognize that. But obviously, this was not someone that was, and I'm glad that they put him in front of the media as soon as possible. So he wasn't able to like fully prepare. And he gave answers that were, you know, kind of along the lines of what I expected and not necessarily in the most encouraging way. I would say, too, yeah. We sort of already talked about this, but it's, again, it's not necessarily about this individual and him being a raging bigot, homophobe, whatever. But what happens is, and this is what is so disappointing, and we've seen versions of this when guys do bad things or get suspended, it is enabling people who are horribly hateful and homophobic to come out and be like, oh, hey, Jarren Duran's saying this word. I'm good. I'm cool. I get to keep on saying this. Yeah.
People saying Jarren Duran, that's my guy. Like, there are people
absurd,
who now have a higher opinion of this person because of what he did. And that is just so warped and sad and unfortunate and a byproduct of suspending him. Obviously, suspending him was the right move.
Yes.
I'm not debating that. It's just kind of, he then becomes this cause celeb within the larger culture war. And it's just such a,
That's part of his consequence, too, because I would hope the most generous interpretation, and I hope, is that he is embarrassed by that, too. You know, and that is part of the learning process. And I would like to believe that is true. And in the way that the teammates talk about it, you hope that's true. But that is why it is so not just problematic, but just so hurtful and so regressive and pushing us backwards. And that's what the rest of the set us back. Yes, that is exactly correct. It's setting us back.
This this whole incident is a mirror of the culture within the game. There are a lot of players for whom that word is the same as any other curse word. That is a problem and bad, but that is the reality. I'm not saying every big leaguer, but in talking to some, you know, big leaguers over the last couple of days about this, the sense I get is that this word is much more commonplace in even in parts of society that are acceptable. The whole thing is disappointing. The whole thing's a bummer, especially within the context of all, you know, Billy Beane's passing last week. Just a reminder that there's a lot more to do. I wrote about it at Yahoo Sports. You can go read my thoughts on that. Juan Soto hit 3 home runs last night, kind of burying the lead here. Pretty incredible.
For the first time, right? I think this was his first 3 homer game. What?
Finally, which is... he stopped walking, coward. Swing the bat.
But no, but I mean, you joke, but like, that's not an irrelevant part of, like, especially a game that Juan Soto has 2 home runs. He already isn't seeing that much to hit. But hey, credit to Grady Sizemore, who clearly is committed to not pitching to Aaron Judge. I'm glad he's like, you know what, Juan Soto, have some fun. Let's make it let's make it happen. And it's nice. It's nice. I'm always happy to alternate, you know, Judge and Soto compliments and historic achievements. That makes me happy. He's amazing.
We have a great email in the drafts from Jake Mintz about Juan Soto that we will get to at some point in the future. I want to pour one out. I want to pour one out for the 2024 Pirates. Let's bring a couple of rocks to their headstone, Jordan. I am confident burying them.
L9.
Yeah. Let's L9. Say Cottage here.
L9. They are, you know, 7 back. They have fallen below the Cubs. They are only a game and a half up on the Nationals.
They're in last place.
They're in last place. And it's all kind of fall apart. They went at 9. I mean, I don't know how many games that is since the trade deadline, but we said it at the time. It's like, okay, great. You traded some prospects for Brian De La Cruz and IKF. All right. Sounds good.
Like, so there's two ways to think about it, though. There's two ways to think about it. On one hand, it's like, good thing they didn't really go for it because it turned out they sucked hard all along. Or it's like, you should have done more to reinforce a team that had a chance, right? You don't lose 9 games in a row if you're just a couple pieces away. The likeliest truth is that this team was never good enough, and you can only have Paul Skeens pitch once every 5 days. Losing Jared Jones was big for them. Some of the other starters had some regression beyond Mitch Keller. And the offense just was underwhelming the whole time. We saw some good things for the Pirates this year, stuff to build on for 25, but spend some money, reinforce the offense, give me something to care about. Last topic before we get out of here, Junior Caminero, called up by the Rays, second best prospect in baseball from a lot of sources, behind Jackson Holliday, who continues to hit for the Baltimore Orioles, home run machine. Junior Caminero, Jordan, give me the 30-second rundown on this guy.
I mean, we saw him very briefly in the big leagues last year, and this is someone who, let's just remind everyone, sorry, Guardians fans, the Rays acquired Junior Caminero for a pitcher named Tobias Myers, who's actually pitching pretty well, but not for Cleveland. This is when Junior Caminero was in the DSL, and the Rays have, they nailed it, right? I mean, they identified a teenage hitter who would very quickly become one of the best prospects in the game. He probably has the best bat speed because he's not a huge guy, but he is producing essentially 80 grade, you know, exit velocities. He's hitting balls 115, 116, 117. And now, because they have traded enough people and are finally ready to kind of turn the chapter, he will be up with Tampa. He is, you know, 20 years or 21. He just turned 21 in July. And we'll see. He's, you know, defense, he'll probably be playing third base. But just as far as guys that I will be wanting to tune in to watch his at-bats, this is absolutely now someone that rockets up that list, regardless of the Rays' place in the standings.
The bat speed is ridiculous.
Yeah.
There are aspects of him just offensively that are Javi Baez-y.
Yes, yes.
Is just a way I would describe it.
Yes.
Both with the chase and the bat speed and just even like the way the swing looks. Defensively, though, this dude got way bigger than I remember him. It seems like he is ticketed to play a corner and not a shortstop. You will see shortstop next to his name. I am a little bit skeptical that he will stick there moving forward. especially for a team like Tampa that cares about shortstop defense a lot.
I would say the last thing I would say about Junior Caminero is with the bat speed comes like genres of home runs that you just don't even really, you can't even really comprehend. Like he had some in the Dominican Winter League and even in the minors where you just like the ball, the batted ball trajectory and just like the flight path and just like where the angle, like none of it really computes and is only possible if you are able to strike the ball in such a specific impactful way. And he can do that and he will be doing that in the big leagues now. And I'm very excited for that.
It reminds me of the home run Javier Baez hit off of Lucas Giolito in the Futures game, which is a homer that is seared into our minds very specifically, but it was just like backside.
Yes.
No doubter. You just don't really see that a whole lot. Last thing on this. The DSL, the Dominican Summer League, is a mystery box in baseball on the public side. Even for nuts like us.
Yeah.
We've never watched that before with our eyes. When you're trying to evaluate minor leaguers, it's very hard. When you're trying to evaluate 17-year-old Latin American players playing on essentially a spring training complex in the Dominican Republic, determining which of those players is worth your time and which ones are not is so difficult. The Rays are exceptionally good at this. Usually they put a lot of time and effort into scouting that league, scouting those types of players. And every once in a while, they turn in a Junior Caminero. Remember, like, same thing with this was what Fernando Tatis Jr. was.
Sure.
The difference just was the name because we knew about his dad.
Yeah. And right now is a good time to be talking about that because I've been talking to people recently about this year's crop of DSL players. And you start with like, okay, who got all the money? Right. You start with the players that signed for $1, $2, $3 million. And then, oh, they have good stats. Okay. That guy's probably awesome. And then it's like, hold on a second. Who's this guy that only signed for 500K or 100K? And he has the best numbers in the league. And you don't really know until they get stateside and you get to full season ball. But the whispers about DSL players is one of my just most fun things in the world. Because like another version of that is like Ellie De La Cruz. I mean, when I wrote about him for the All-Star, he was unremarkable in the DSL. He was projectable, whatever. It was not obvious. Caminero is a little bit different because you talk to scouts that saw him there. It was like, he was pretty freaking good. And I don't really know why Cleveland traded him.
But he only got a quarter mil, right? Which is a relatively small signing bonus. He only got $225,000. Jordan Alvarez is another guy like this, right? O'Neill Cruz, both of them were with the Dodgers in the DSL.
The Cubans are a little different because there's even more mystery involving their development and timeline. But no, that is all fair. Jake, last thing I will say about Junior Caminero, and then we will say goodbye. Junior Caminero was born on July 5th, 2003. I know Jack Soteriò born March 2004. We're getting really used to this. Yet another player younger than the debut album of Avril Lavigne. Yes, Jake, as I wear my Avril Lavigne Greatest Hits Tour t-shirt, all I want to say is it was fantastic. Thanks for asking. We hope that you all enjoyed this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. We'll be back on Friday as I will finally be home from my Canadian journey. And, not talk about the Mariners losing by a million runs last night, which I was also in attendance for. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. That's BARBcast. We will talk to you all on Friday. Jake Mitz.
Avril finished with I'm With You. That's great. That's awesome. That's lovely.